MTV's official Challenge podcast is back for another season.
And so are we.
I'm Tori Deal.
And I'm Anissa Ferreira.
The wait is over, guys. All Stars 4 is finally here.
And this season takes it to a whole new level. Old school legends, modern power players, and ex-lovers are all competing in Cape Town, South Africa for the prize of $300,000.
And we're going to be right here along with you fans, covering every episode on the podcast.
Listen to MTV's official Challenge podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome to Season 9 of Next Question with me, Katie Couric. I've got some big news to share with you in our season premiere featuring the one and only Kris Jenner.
Oh my gosh, congratulations. That is very, very exciting.
And that's just the beginning. We'll also be joined by podcast host Jay Shetty, Hillary Clinton, Renee Fleming, Liz Cheney, and many more. So come on in, take a break from the incessant negativity for a weekly dose of fascinating conversations. Some of them, I promise, will actually put you in a good mood. Listen to Next Question with me, Katie Couric, on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Bring a little optimism into your life with The Bright Side, a new kind of daily podcast from Hello Sunshine, hosted by me, Danielle Robay.
And me, Simone Boyce. Every weekday, we're bringing you conversations about culture, the latest trends, inspiration, and so much more.
I am so excited about this podcast, The Bright Side. You guys are giving people a chance to shine a light on their lives, shine a light on a little advice that they want to share.
Listen to The Bright Side on America's number one podcast network, iHeart. Open your free iHeart app and search The Bright Side.
Imagine you ask two people the same seven questions. I'm Minnie Driver, and this was the idea I set out to explore in my podcast, Mini Questions. This year, we bring a whole new group of guests to answer the same seven questions, including Courtney Cox, Rob Delaney, Liz Phair, and many, many more. Join me on season three of Mini Questions on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your favorite podcasts. Seven questions, limitless answers.
Hi, I'm Molly Jongfast, and this is Fast Politics, where we discuss the top political headlines with some of today's best minds.
And transgender people in Florida now face the state taking their driver's licenses.
We have a star-studded show today. E. Jean Carroll and Robbie Kaplan join us to talk about their massive victory over former President Trump and what's next in their quest for justice. Brian Kloss talks to us about his new book, Fluke, Chance, Chaos, and Why Everything We Do Matters. But first, we have former senator and host of the Al Franken podcast, the one, the only Al Franken. Welcome back to You Fast Politics. One of my favorite guests, Al Franken.
Well, you're my favorite host.
Except for like hosts who have like TV shows and stuff.
No.
So I want to start by talking about this insane border legislation. I had breakfast with Chris Murphy on Friday morning at Steak and Eggs. Have you ever been there?
No, but it sounds like I know what their menu is.
And I had an omelet.
Oh, okay.
With cheddar cheese.
That's eggs. That's eggs.
I'm getting to the headline here. And he said they had been working on this border package for like about 3.5 months. And it's Lankford, him, and everyone's favorite independent. She's not even everyone's favorite independent, right? Because Bernie Sanders is everybody's favorite.
It's Sinema.
It was Sinema, but she's not everybody's favorite independent. And that they had something, but of course, you know, what did that mean? So you actually have worked with Lankford. I mean, you've worked with all these people, but you've certainly worked with Lankford.
And Chris, yeah.
And yeah, so we were just talking about, I would be curious, let's talk about this insanity.
Well, Lankford is very, very conservative and on the border. And basically what they were trying to do is come up with something that both sides could live with. And we do have a problem at the border. I don't know what's in the package. No one actually knows what it is. But clearly it's going to be something much stricter in terms of letting people in and getting people out. And they had a deal that included funding the war in Ukraine and Israel. So they had it worked out, and they had worked on it for how many months? I don't know. What did Chris tell you, like 4 months or 5 months or something like that. They've been working on this, I'm sure, constantly, maybe much longer. And they had a package and that they were going to go with. And then Trump said, I don't want it because I want to have it not solved. I don't want Biden to take credit.
I want something to run on, right?
Yeah. And they went, oh, okay. I mean, you know, McConnell went, all right, well, okay, that's what you want. We want more judges, you know, and we want fascists running the government. So,
right, because of the tax cut. Let me ask you a question about Mitch McConnell here, because you actually know him too. When Mitch McConnell said Trump wants us to kill this deal, was Mitch McConnell actually trying to throw Trump under the bus? Or was Mitch McConnell just speaking truth to power?
I think what he was doing is, well, if I say this, either he'll get thrown under the bus or it'll help him. I don't know, but I'm doing what I'm supposed to do right now for my own politics. And that's, I think, what he did. I think he was being sincere, though, actually, that he was saying, like, okay, now we got it. Now we got to do what the boss says and get him elected. That's what they want. And that's that way they get judges and that way they get, you know, they get what they want.
It's such an insane thing to think about for a minute here, because here's Mitch McConnell. This is probably, I mean, I don't know, maybe he runs again. Never underestimate the ability of senators to refuse to leave. But it does seem like, you know, here you are into your older years and you realize that your legacy is going to be just like Trump patsy.
Yeah. Well, you know, everybody is Trump's patsy basically on the Republican Party right now. And that's the politics. They want a Republican president. He's the nominee. That's clear. And he demands that kind of loyalty and fealty, and he gets it. They've surrendered.
So it seems like now, even though Republicans don't control the Senate and they only control the House by, I think it's two right now.
Right,
two votes.
Right.
If Swazi wins, then that'll be one. Right. So you would just need one Republican.
Just one to get COVID.
Well, that wasn't what I was thinking, but you could just one to say, you know, this party is really pathetic. I'm going to switch. And you have a speaker, Hakeem Jeffries.
I hadn't thought of that. I don't know any Republican House member who would do that, but I don't know I don't know hardly any of them anyway.
Right. I mean, you only need one. And there are a lot of them who are on their way out, right? I mean, I'm just saying, like a Patrick McHenry, you know, somebody, I mean, obviously Patrick McHenry is not going to do it because he comes from Freedom Caucus and is ultimately probably as bad as the rest of them.
Yeah, you know the House a lot better than I did. Name someone who would do this. And then what would happen to them?
They'd have to hire Mitt Romney levels of private security. So they'd have to be quite rich. I mean, yeah, it just seems unlikely that there really isn't anyone who could do that. Not even could. I mean, any of them could, but none of them would. The thing I'm so struck by, I want you to talk about this for a minute, because this is something I feel like we don't talk about, but is actually really important. Like, the economy is quite good, and Biden made this big announcement to pause natural gas export because we are now the largest exporter of natural gas in the entire world.
And a lot of that kind of happened because of the war in Ukraine and Europe not taking gas from Russia.
Yeah. So here we are, a gas giant, pausing it because Biden actually cares about the environment and wants to look at the impact of some of the what this is doing to indigenous people, what this is, you know, a sort of study. But it's clearly easy to ramp up. It means that the OPEC does not have the monopoly it once did. It means a lot of really good things. So business leaders are not embracing Biden, even though the economy is so good. This is like this weird dichotomy where Democrats don't get credit for good economies and Republicans do, and then polling shows that people trust Republicans better on the economy. Why does this happen?
Well, that's good propaganda by Republicans. Actually, Biden's economy and his job creation numbers are higher than Trump's, and we have to advertise that. That's something we have to be talking about. And people are beginning to feel it. I mean, there has been that lag since that since 9% inflation. And that scared the bejesus out of people. They had not seen that since, the 70s. And there's a lag from that people are beginning to see the economy is picking up, that the stock market is at the highest, and that affects people's pensions, obviously, and their 401ks, et cetera. I think that there's enough time between now and the election for people to see that Biden has been a much better steward of the economy than Trump has, just in terms of job creation.
It's like they all just want a tax cut.
I don't think all wealthy people want a tax cut.
No, but I mean, all these Republicans just want a tax cut, right?
Yeah, Americans don't. Trump voters don't. Yes, Trump voters, should people at the top be paying more? They'll say yes. They don't like the elites. They feel like the elites are self-serving, and that's what the Republicans are. They're self-serving for people at the top. And so this is one of the basic fights that we have, and it's one that we really need to be pressing and that Biden needs to be pressing, which is, hey, everybody, we're for taxing people at the top at a higher level. That's what we do. That's our thing. All polling shows that Americans want that, including Trump voters.
Yeah. No, I mean, this is the thing. It's economic populism. Somehow the party that is the economic populist party cannot get credit for it.
Well, we have to be loud about it. And this is where Biden needs to get out and do rallies. And Biden needs to go out and show that he can do rallies. And he needs to be hitting these points over and over again.
Yeah, we're in this news crisis, right? We're in this mainstream media crisis where, like, there's such a drop off in local news. A lot of these really good papers are gone or going. Massive layoffs this year. Like, if you look at the numbers, they're humongous.
And where people get their local news now is from talk radio. And talk radio is all this right-wing blather.
And also from social media, right? Which is like, Jesse can tell us what's happening on TikTok. But the algorithm did have, again, I know this is not a huge group, but they did have Osama bin Laden's, was it Osama bin Laden? Yes. His letter to America trending.
Yes.
Poor Jesse has to unmute.
Osama bin Laden's letter to America?
Yes. Jesse, tell Al Franken this story, please. Unmute. He's poor Jesse.
Osama bin Laden's letter to America trended on TikTok when the Israel October 7th started, because it was an indictment of American imperialism, and the kids found it relevant for some reason.
Oh, the kids.
Yeah.
I'm really glad to be the voice of this. This is really what the paycheck pays me for.
And there's some sense in which it's very possible that the algorithm may have helped this out, right?
The algorithm. Once something starts to trend, then it just goes nuts. Is that it?
Yeah. With TikTok, again, there is a sense in which the algorithm supports more of a negative bent in America versus in China, where it encourages children to read and be good.
I see. So, and that's what was in Osama bin Laden's letter?
No, definitely not.
Oh, I was just confused there for a second.
The death to America refrain was pretty strong, as I recall, from the early days of the 2000s.
Yeah, not great.
So Osama bin Laden wrote two letters, one for Chinese TikTok. Which is a wholesome, listen to your parents, do your homework, try to get into an American university. That's because it was written several years ago. He doesn't say that anymore. He wouldn't.
He was known for his Miss Cleo-like abilities to see the future.
Try to go to an American university, but don't fly there. Go by boat.
Anyway, the point is, yes. I'm sorry. Please help me.
That was dark. I'm sorry.
It was really dark, but it was sort of hilarious. But again, here we are on the precipice of another Trump-Biden showdown. And I think there's a lot of anxiety, right? I mean, why do the stakes have to continually be so high?
Well, the stakes are incredibly high right now. Did you notice? We have the possibility of Donald Trump being elected, and the second term is going to be very different than the first, meaning it's going to be the first on steroids. I mean, it's going to be, he'll, one, be vindicated, and two, there'll be just no holes barred. And I assume that if he wins, there may very well be a Republican Senate and may very well be a Republican House, although I don't see them holding the House because I think Americans have been watching this House enough.
Just see us so bad.
To see how, I mean, this is a spectacularly bad House. I actually see possibility of both houses flipping. Trump, this is an existential threat to our democracy. And if he becomes president, where this country, the nature of this democracy changes, meaning it may not be one in, at the end of 4 years.
Yeah.
We got 9 months of this, of being scared.
You know, it's funny because it's like, it's not funny, but it's the, like, do you want to have elections? Election. I was listening to NPR and they were talking about how Trump is only eligible to serve 4 more years. And I'm thinking to myself, like, oh, okay, well, I'm sure then he'll stick by that.
I see him doing all kinds of things. I worry about him switching the parliamentarian in the Senate and trying to do everything with 50 votes, if he has 50. If you look at the history of autocracies, there's all kinds of things he can do. You know, and at a certain point, the autocrat says, nope, we're changing this, and he's able to. This is as frightening as it is. Last night I was on CNN, I read just a couple of things, and I want to get these guys to start speaking out. This is James Mattis, who was, of course, Secretary of Defense, talking about Trump. He is more dangerous than anyone could ever imagine. Now, he said this, and these guys tend to say these things once or write them once. They got to start talking like every day. This is John Kelly, who was his chief of staff, right? The depths of his dishonesty is just astounding to me. He is the most flawed person I have ever met in my life. Now, it's sort of up to these guys, I think, not to say this once, but to be saying it every day. And they're supposed to be patriots. They were military. They love this country. This guy is so dangerous, and we need everybody, not just hopefully Taylor Swift, because she didn't serve with him. She didn't, you know, she didn't see it up close. And these guys did. I mean, there's on and on it goes with these people. And they say these things once and again, quoted in some story, but they have to come out. So this is my new thing. I'm just pounding this. You guys come out and start talking every day.
Yeah, exactly. Al Franken, thank you so much for joining us.
You bet, Molly. Always a pleasure. Always fun, except now.
AI might be the most important new computer technology ever. It's storming every industry, and literally billions of dollars are being invested. So buckle up. The problem is that AI needs a lot of speed and processing power. So how do you compete without costs spiraling out of control? It's time to upgrade to the next generation of the cloud. Oracle Cloud Infrastructure, or OCI. OCI is a single platform for your infrastructure, database, application development, and AI needs. OCI has 4 to 8 times the bandwidth of other clouds, offers one consistent price instead of variable regional pricing, and of course, nobody does data better than Oracle. So now you can train your AI models at twice the speed and less than half the cost of other clouds. If you want to do more and spend less like Uber, 8x8, and Databricks Mosaic, take a free test drive of OCI at oracle.com/strategic. That's oracle.com/strategic. oracle.com/strategic.
Sick of being upsold at gyms?
My guy, you're currently a base member. For $90 more, I can upgrade you to our Shred membership. For $130 more, you'll be a Swole member. And for just $300 more, you'll reach Sweat Platinum.
At Planet Fitness, you'll get energy without the upsell. Never pushy, always free fitness training and equipment for every workout. It's fitness that fits your budget. Join Planet Fitness for just $1 down and $10 a month. Cancel anytime. Deal ends Friday, May 10th. See Home Club for details.
If you love sports and true crime, then there's a new podcast from executive producer Dan Patrick and hosted by me, Jay Harris, that you won't want to miss. Playing Dirty Sports Scandals. Each week, I'm squeezing the juiciest details from some of the biggest sports scandals ever. I'm talking Marcus Dixon, Olympic gymnastics, Cain Velasquez, salacious Super Bowl-level scandals. Join me on the dark side of sports by listening to Playing Dirty Sports Scandals on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey, I'm Rachel Martin. You probably know how interview podcasts with famous people usually go, right? There's a host, a guest, and a light Q&A. On NPR's new podcast, Wildcard, we have ripped up the typical script. It's part existential deep dive and part game show. I ask actors, artists, and comedians to play a game using a special deck of cards to ask some of life's biggest questions. Listen to NPR's Wildcard on the iHeartRadio app or wherever you get your podcasts.
E. Jean Carroll is a columnist and author. Roberta Kaplan is a lawyer who represented E. Jean Carroll in her case against Donald Trump, as well as arguing United States v. Windsor. Welcome back to Fast Politics, Robbie Kaplan and E. Jean Carroll.
Yay! You do a much better yay than me, E. Jean.
I want to talk to you about this case because I remember when I introduced George to E. Jean, he said, oh, I know the lawyer. I know the lawyer. I know the woman who can do this case. How did you know George, Robbie?
You know, I don't think I really knew him. I mean, he was a lot tough many years while I was at Paul Weiss. I certainly knew who he was because lawyers at firms like that kind of generally know each other. I don't think we ever had a case together, or I can't recall any circumstances in which we interacted. But when Trump was elected and George, who I thought was remarkably not only prescient but courageous in disavowing him right away as a conservative Republican, we somehow became acquainted. And I don't, honestly, when he made that call, I'm not even sure we'd ever met yet.
It's so interesting because it's like the thing you were so famous for was same-sex marriage,
right?
Arguing that in front of the Supreme Court. It's a different kind of moral courage, but it's similar in a certain way, right?
I don't know how to answer that. I think George is more courageous doing what he did, because I was my decision on Windsor was very popular among the people I hung out with. George, his decision was exceedingly unpopular in the group of people he hung out with. So, very. My wife supported me. His wife, not so much. Yeah.
She's not a fan of mine either. So let's talk about how this case went and sort of a little bit about, as you were getting going in it, how was the process? This is all because of this Adult Survivors Act too, right?
The case that was tried first, that was tried last spring,
right,
was all because of the Adult Survivors Act, which E. Jean herself helped bring about.
And that is the second case, right?
Yeah, it was the second case that was filed. It just moved a lot faster because it didn't have any of these complicated issues about federal power and whether he was president, et cetera.
Right. Can you talk a little bit about the Adult Survivors Act and also E. Jean's involvement in that?
Sure. So the Adult Survivors Act was a law that grew out of the realization by many, many people that women who had been sexually assaulted, for example, at the time that E. Jean was assaulted, and even for years and years before that, quite rationally, in my view, at that point in time, would have and could have and probably should have made the decision not to report it. We weren't a society that was particularly open to those issues. The DA's offices weren't particularly open to those issues. And so a lot of women, again, rationally decided to keep it quiet. So the Adult Survivors Act said, look, if that had happened to you many years ago and you could no longer bring a claim because of what's called the statute of limitations, which means your case is barred by the time limits, you can have a free 1 year look back, essentially, in which during the course of that year, you can bring those claims and statute of limitations are not a defense. That's basically what it did. That period is now over. It began two Thanksgivings ago, and it ended last Thanksgiving. E. Jean, you should talk about your role of getting it passed.
Yes, please do.
Molly, as you know, I'm not good at politics. I don't know how to even go about it. Robbie's wife, Rachel Levine, was my coach, because I took it upon myself to write to every single member of the House of Representatives in Albany. I didn't know how to...
The Assembly.
the assembly, all the assembly members. Molly, how do you write a letter to all the assembly members in Albany? And she really coached me through. So that was the first thing we did. Second thing we did is I went to Albany with Rachel Tuckman, one of our great lawyers here. And Rachel, at the time, she didn't want anybody to know, was 6 weeks pregnant. And that woman ran up. You've been to Albany, Molly, right? The staircase or wherever that thing is called. There are so many stairs in the New York Capitol. And that woman in 6 weeks who was told she should not be traveling, walking, driving. She went down the stairs. We got in the elevator. We went from office to office, knocking on doors, introducing ourselves. And here's the thing, Molly. Nobody wanted to talk to us. Nobody. Nobody wants to hear about sexual assault. They feel bad about it. They don't know how to handle it. They don't want two women knocking on their doors. Sexual assault. You know, they just don't accept Linda Rosenthal. She said, come on in, girls. And we sat down and she helped us plot out. And Senator Brad Holliman, those two really, and plus the letters, I think, and a little bit. And lo and behold, the thing passed. It passed. Amazing. It made all the difference. And look what happened. Remember at the end, everybody, remember what last month when everybody started coming forward on, remember on Puff Daddy?
So this Adult Survivors Act, there's a certain window in which you can come forward. And I think, when does it end? I think it ended last month, right?
There might have some extensions for whatever reason, but it's over. It ended about a little bit ago. I think the woman who sued, or purported to sue Sean Combs, was doing some under New York City law, which was about to expire. I think the Adult Survivors Act expired around Thanksgiving.
Okay.
November 22nd, 2023.
I don't know. We spend so much time on this podcast talking about conservatives going into the legal system to take away our rights, especially after Roe. It's really interesting, the idea that you could conceivably change these rights so that survivors would have more rights.
Right. Yeah, well, that's what happened. That's exactly what happened. More rights were got more rights.
I mean, part of the right side in terms of kind of what's happening legally and at SCOTUS right now, theoretically, at least, the state should have a lot more power. And so states like New York and California and others that want to pass progressive legislation should have more power to do so as the Supreme Court kind of gets rid of all these federal protections.
It's a halcyon thought, but unlikely, right? I mean, ultimately their goal is just to dismantle the federal government so they can do whatever they want. I'm curious. So just tell me about the sort of process of waiting. I mean, Eugene, I'm sure that you were flooded with vitriol. I always find like that it actually kind of gets to me. Even though I say it doesn't get to me, it sort of gets to me.
Oh, Molly, it's intense today.
Yep.
Very intense today. After we did Maddow last night and we did yesterday, you know, the morning shows, and they just are, because we really trounced Donald Trump. And it's making people a little insane, his supporters. They really can't believe that an elderly woman and a hotshot lawyer and a team of young, just indestructible attorneys, almost, well, 95% of us were women, just trounced him. So it's making people a little nervous. And so they strike out at Robbie and me.
So I think a lot about this. Like, you're my mom's age. You're a little younger than my mom. And you are Donald Trump's age, right?
No, I'm 80. Your mom's
83.
I had told you, Molly, I was walking down the street. Erica John was the first celebrity I saw. And I had just come in from Montana. I'm walking down the avenue. And here comes this vision. Blonde hair, yards of it, flying out around her head. And this was a woman I worshipped, reading in my little Montana cabin, Fear of Flying, made such an impression on all of us. And she's coming towards me. I'm walking my dog. I just couldn't believe it. I was in New York, Erica John, herself walking down the street, and she was so, I was not prepared for her beauty. Much of which you create and you've inherited with your massive amounts of, well, I don't know. What color is your hair today, Molly?
It's red and blonde. So, but let me ask you, now you're in this moment where Trump and his followers and his are, you know, he's not going to pay a penny of it. We're going to appeal, da, 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 da. Talk me through next steps.
So here's where we are right now. The verdict has come in. Trump has an opportunity, which I'm sure he will take, to file what are called post-trial motions, basically arguments to the judge that the jury verdict should be set aside. Those arguments have about a 0% chance of success. Once Judge Kaplan denies those motions, then he will issue what's called the judgment. And then Trump has, I think it's 30 days to either seek an appellate bond or to deposit about $89 or $90 million with the court. Last time when the verdict was only $5 million, he actually deposited $5.5 million with the court. This time, he's either got to get a bond or he has to deposit $90 million. If he doesn't, that means that we can start enforcing right away.
So what does that mean?
That means we can say, give us, pay us the money. And if he can't pay it all, we're allowed to get information about his bank accounts, about his checking accounts, about how much he's earning, his tax statements, et cetera.
And that will ultimately destroy the myth of Donald Trump.
I don't know that for a fact, but I wouldn't be shocked. You mean the myth of him as being wealthy?
Yeah, well, I mean, you'll be able to see everything he's hidden for so long.
So when does that mean our case closes, Robin? When does our case close?
Our case closes, finally closes, when the appellate court is done with it, the Second Circuit. And if he seeks review to the Supreme Court, which I think is extremely doubtful here, but when they probably say, no, we're not taking the case.
Okay, so our case will remain open.
So it'll switch courts. It'll go from the district court to the Second Circuit. But it will remain open.
He defames me again.
Yes.
Is our case still open?
No, we would have to file. If we want to bring a case, we'd have to file yet another case. Carol 3.
I see. Okay.
But I'm curious now. You had this experience of being in these depositions with him. Can we talk a little bit about what that was like? What was that like?
It was not as crazy, believe it or not, as the trial, which was one of the craziest things I've ever experienced. But it was pretty crazy.
Can you tell the story of what he said to you?
I did 2 depositions with him. The first one was in another case that's a fraud case, really. And at the end of that deposition, he was not happy with me. And at the end of that deposition, they said something like, off the record, to make sure that everything was turned off. And he said to me, see you next Tuesday. I, fortunately for me, had no idea what that meant. So I said to him, what are you talking about? I'm coming back on Wednesday. Literally what I said. It sounds like I was being witty, but it was just ignorant. And then we got in the car and my associates, my colleagues told me what he meant. And I was like, thank God I didn't know because I would have gotten very upset. Mm-hmm. And then a week later, that next Wednesday, we were there for the E. Jean Carroll deposition. And that's where, you know, he made these very, very significant errors, including, you know, talking about the Access Hollywood tape and saying how fortunately or unfortunately men had been able to get away with that for millions of years, and looking at a photo of E. Jean, her then husband, Donald Trump, and his then wife, and pointing to E. Jean and saying, that's Marla Maples.
That was incredible. I remember talking to you after that, just seeing you socially somewhere. It's just so, like, it just negates all the lies he was saying about her.
Yeah, I mean, I was, because when you listen to the video, I'm kind of like soft, my voice is very soft, and I said, did you just say that was Marla Maples? Did I say something like that? Because I'm so shocked.
Unbelievable.
Remember, Molly, he says to Robbie, he said, and no offense, but I'm not attracted to you either.
You're not my type.
You're not my type either. And of course, he ends the thing on a tirade against Romney. You know, she's a Democratic operative, et cetera, et cetera. That's how he ended that. Oh, Robbie, tell him I had for lunch.
That was the first deposition. He looks to me. He said, well, I wanted to. I said, okay, sir, I'm going to cover this one more topic and then we'll break for lunch. And he said, why do we have to break for lunch? I just want to go straight through. And I said, look, I would. But there's a court reporter here. There's a videographer there titled to lunch break. So we're going to have to take a break. And then you could kind of see his brain clicking. And he said, well, you're here in Mar-a-Lago. What do you think you're going to eat for lunch? And I said, well, I actually raised this with your attorneys yesterday, including Alina Hobb, I think. And I said, and they graciously offered to provide us with lunch, at which point he took a huge pile of papers and threw them across the table.
It really does seem unfit, right?
Yeah. And all of that, Molly, is nothing, literally nothing, compared to the way he acted in that courtroom.
Yeah. First, I want you to talk about the pointing, because I think that's really interesting. And then I want you to talk about how much candidate Trump really hurt defendant Trump.
Oh, yeah. And the answer is a lot. So in terms of the pointing, I didn't even see it, because when I'm in court, I'm very formal. I don't turn back, and I was facing forward. But I realized afterwards, I think a reporter told me that during her rebuttal, Sean Crowley, who's quite tall and was wearing heels, so she was super tall, every time she mentioned Donald Trump, stood and kind of pointed at him. He would have been to her left. Yeah. And apparently he was just like glaring at her, and she's pointing at him, and it was quite something. Very, very courageous of her. Dramatic.
I would love you to just talk about what happened in the courthouse that you felt like really hurt him.
There's a kind of a way, I think, to reduce, to concentrate it all down. And think about it this way. In this case, which was only about damages, and in which we really focused on all his repeated defamations of E. Jean, even those after the verdict in the last case, continuing during this trial, like he would leave the courthouse and he would go and defame E. Jean again. If that's the subject of the case, and you're basically saying to the jury, here's a man who's a bully, who cannot follow the rules, who thinks they don't apply to him, acting in the courtroom like a bully who can't follow the rules, is arguably not a great strategy. I think at one point I said it's the anti-strategy. That's not a great idea. And so we were joking the other day, I'm not even sure Sean and I needed to close. I think we could have just like sat down because they saw it all for themselves.
Oh no, you're closing, Molly. Have you read this transcript yet?
No. Well, talk to us about the closing arguments.
Oh, it was brilliantly built. It was moving. It was powerful. Robbie had the jury in the palm of her hand. This jury is very odd, Molly. They were very intensely paying attention, but they didn't think it was correct to look at the attorneys. They were very careful not to give them. They didn't even look at it during the closing argument. They looked at Ross.
Sure, they were torturing us because they literally would not look our way.
They would not look our way. But during the closing, you were aware, Robbie, that every once in a while they would look at you because you could not look away because she was describing what the man had done. And she told a riveting story. And of course, she was, and had only just begun, and had she so incited him that when you could hear a pin drop in the courtroom for the closing was so amazing, when everybody was riveted to her, he stands up. And I don't think he walks out. He stalked out. He stalked out. And Robbie is, of course, as she's told you, she was unaware. Judge Kaplan had to say, for the record, the defendant has left the courtroom, I think. Or he said something like that. Trump has left the courtroom. And Robbie, of course, doesn't miss a beat. She goes right on with the next thing. She didn't miss the flow. She just went on. And it was, well, it drove him from the room. He did come back.
For Haba.
He left because he was obviously couldn't control himself. Maybe. I mean, it seems like.
Only about 8 minutes into my closing, which was an hour. So, yeah, at the very beginning.
Wow. And then he came back later?
He came back when I was done to watch Alina Hobb close. And then maybe because they convinced him he couldn't do it again,
right,
he had to stay for Sean Crowley's rebuttal. Yeah.
Oh, wow. Can you just talk to us about his legal representation? Because he used to have Joe Tacopina, right?
Yeah, right. The first trial.
Yeah. And then he switched. Was Alina Hobb the person who should be taking a trial like this?
I'm not. That's not for me to say. But I don't think she's had a lot of trial experience. And Judge Kaplan is a very strict, he said it on the record, a very formal judge who expects lawyers not only to behave, but to do things in the proper way. And if you don't know how to do things in the proper way, he loses patience, which he lost many, many, many times. And she would really talk to him. I mean, the one thing that was the most stressful part of it all and why it was so much crazier than the depositions is between Trump kind of shrugging and walking out and making gestures and kind of talking under his breath, and Haba directly challenging the judge in the most obstinate and disrespectful way. Like the very first day, she said to him, "I really don't appreciate how you're speaking to me. Like, I can't, I have to tell you, Molly, I can't imagine saying that to a judge."
Yeah.
"I don't know what drug I would have to be on to say that to a judge." So it was always tense because you kind of never knew when those things were going to happen. Judge Kaplan did an amazing job of keeping his equanimity, but it was a struggle.
Yeah.
Yeah. And the jury, they were protected. They're anonymous jurors. This is a pretty unusual thing to do, right?
Yeah. So it's not uncommon in criminal cases. Like in terrorism cases, it happens all the time. But in civil cases, it's very rare. They did it in my Charlottesville Nazi case for similar reason. Yeah, I think it was among the many smart decisions that the judge made, this might have been the smartest because the jury felt completely safe and completely protected. And at the end, he said to them, "You know, I can't tell you not to speak to the lawyers or not to expose yourselves. But if I were you, I would tell you not to. My advice to you would be not to do that."
That's not burning.
Yeah.
Wow. It feels so chilling. Robbie Kaplan, E. Jean Carroll, thank you guys so much. Really appreciate you both.
Thank you.
Thank you, Molly.
Brian Kloss is the author of Fluke, Chance, Chaos, and Why Everything We Do Matters. Welcome back to Fast Politics, Brian Kloss.
Thanks for having me on the show again.
Your book is called Fluke, Chance, Chaos, and Why Everything We Do Matters. So explain to us a little bit about why you got here to write this book.
Yeah, so there's sort of two stories. I mean, one is I think that the world works this way, and it's swayed by these small shocks that have big consequences, and we just pretend otherwise. So the opening story of the book is about a vacation that a couple took to Kyoto, Japan in 1926. And the husband of the couple, 19 years later, ends up as the Secretary of War for the United States. And in 1945, he's the chief civilian in charge of where to drop the atomic bomb. And the target committee basically says they want to drop it on Kyoto, and they send it to Truman and so on. And Stimson, because he is the husband of this couple that went there in 1926, because he has a soft spot for the city, he twice meets with Truman and gets it taken off the list. And so the first atomic bomb is dropped on Hiroshima purely because an American government official went on holiday 19 years earlier to Kyoto and decided he didn't want the city destroyed. So, I think as a political scientist, there's that aspect, which is like the world does shift this way. On a personal level, the sort of origin story of the book is that there's a story from my family history where a woman in 1905 in rural Wisconsin had a mental breakdown and tragically decided to kill her four children and then kill herself. And her husband came home and found the whole family dead. And this is my great-grandfather and his first wife. He remarried to my great-grandmother, and the only reason I exist is because of this mass murder. So I feel like a cosmic accident, a bit of a fluke, as it were. But
Jesus, it's pretty rough.
No, but the really strange thing about this is like, you know, Molly, we wouldn't be talking if these kids didn't get killed, right? And I think like that's the thing that we ignore. Like there's all these ripple effects in politics, in society, and in our own lives, which is why I talk about chaos theory in the book a lot. But it's like, you know, when we tell the stories of politics, when we go on MSNBC, as both of us do, to explain politics, like it's always big reasons for big events, right? And I think there's a lot of ripple effects that are sort of lurking there that explain the world better often than the sort of obvious variables, because you wouldn't imagine that the vacation history of a government official would cause the atomic bomb to land on one city rather than another.
Yeah, I mean, for sure true. And I think important. So we look at right now, I mean, I guess, yeah, you could say like the World War I, right, was started by a fluke. Right. Archduke. World War II. Right. I mean, there are all these different things that are started, you know, we don't know what things will lead to. It's interesting. So now when we look at Trump and Trumpism, do we see that there's like, it doesn't feel like a fluke led us to Trumpism as much as just like a continual hostility of a group of people who liked Trump's racism and economic populism?
I think there are flukes that we can see very clearly with Trump, though. I mean, one of them, for example, is there's speculation that he decided to run for president in 2011 when the White House Correspondents' Dinner happened.
I knew you were going to say that when Obama was making those jokes, right?
Yeah, and Obama humiliated him. Whether this is true or not, I don't know, but that's one possibility. So maybe he doesn't run. Then you get to the 2016 election, right? You got 70,000-80,000 votes to decide the race in three states. And part of the reason why the FBI investigation is reopened is because of Anthony Weiner, right? If this doesn't happen, maybe Comey doesn't make his statement. Maybe Clinton narrowly wins. And then we have a totally different narrative, right? Because Brexit then becomes the outlier of populism. And it's the high water mark of it. And we say, oh, well, but then Clinton wins as the establishment figure. So maybe populism is dead. I mean, there's all these things where a lot of things pivot on very small, narrow, sort of outcomes. And, there's some really strange stuff, too. I talk about this in the book briefly, and it's a little bit in the weeds. But if you look at the 2020 election results, there's this little swoop across Georgia, this blue swoop in the counties where Biden basically racks up enough votes to win. And also the Democrats end up winning in Georgia in the Senate and control the Senate. That crescent shape, that if you look up the county level election results, it is literally caused by an ancient inland sea at the time of the dinosaurs, because there was phytoplankton that lived there and they died and became really rich soil. So when slavery was established, they put all the plantations on this swoop. And then all of the enslaved people were brought there, and then they were freed and they stayed there. And this is where a lot of the black population in Georgia lives that votes Democrat. So, right. There's all these things where if you take the long sweep of history, yeah, you can see geological contingencies and so on. But there's also aspects about, I think what we do as pundits or analysts is we stitch history backwards. So something happens, this was inevitable. Trump was always going to rise because of these undercurrents. But if he'd lost in 2016, there would have been a really different America, I think. And so, there could have been this backlash to Trumpism, this sort of condemnation in the Republican Party saying, oh, well, he was never going to win anyway. And then maybe the party isn't authoritarian and overtly racist, right? So, I think there's a lot of these moments in history where it could have pivoted slightly differently. And that's, not to mention the fact that Trump was sort of made into this kingpin celebrity apprentice guy when actually he was a business failure. If they pick somebody else, maybe he doesn't rise, So I think basically what happens is when you try to make sense of politics, you are told to look for big causes for big effects that are really obvious. And I think that when you look in detail at history, that very quickly falls apart, as we all know in our own lives, right? I mean, we've seen all these little happenstance moments. I think the really bewildering thing is the stuff that we don't ever see, right? The stuff in our lives, the sliding doors sort of moments where you hit the snooze button and your life might unfold slightly differently. You can only observe the life you live. And I think that's true for politics as well.
Yeah, it's super interesting. And yeah, Brexit. Yeah, I wonder about that too. And Trump, he did manage to... The Electoral College itself feels very flukish, because we've now seen this happen a bunch of times where a candidate has won the Electoral College and lost the popular vote and gone on to be president, which is just completely strange. The fluke thing I always think about is this is so sick, but I think, what if Mitt Romney had won? I didn't like Mitt Romney at the time, but now I think if Mitt Romney had been president, perhaps, that the Republican Party wouldn't have lost its mind.
Yeah. So, I think that's definitely a fair counterfactual to consider. And if he'd won, he would have been the nominee in 2016, almost certainly. Right. So then that would have knocked out Trump in 2016. I think what's really striking, if you look at the 21st century, though, is that our politics and our lives have been just walloped over and over and over by these shocks. Right. You look at the 21st century, it's 9/11, the Iraq War, the financial crisis, the Arab Spring, which was started by a guy literally lighting himself on fire in central Tunisia. Then you have, Brexit, Trump, the pandemic started by a mutated virus infecting one person in China. And then you have, Gaza and Ukraine and so on. And sort of these constant upheavals. And I think the thing that, I argue in Fluke as well is that we've engineered a system that's really prone to this, right? Because we've set up systems where the world operates with no slack. Probably the best example of this was a couple years ago when a gust of wind hit a boat in the Suez Canal and twisted sideways. It wiped out $54 billion of economic output. And it's from one boat, So I think this stuff Trump's presidency also pivots to a large degree on COVID or January 6th. What if they had taken it a bit more seriously and had sort of broken it up, or they didn't allow the protest movement to even get started or whatever? Or if January 6th, there's a great contingency here where the guys with the zip ties, they get really close. Let's imagine they actually get somebody who's in Congress or in the Senate and kill them. Does that mean that Trump can rebound the way he has in 2024? I mean, maybe, but maybe not, right? So I think this is all these things with these split second changes or small changes, Anthony Weiner's cell phone or a joke about, you know, Trump in 2011. I think we just write that out as noise. And the wisdom, the received wisdom you get is like, you know, ignore the noise, focus on the signal. And I'm not sure that's a good idea. I think there's a lot of stuff in our politics that is swayed by noise.
Yeah, I mean, for sure. I think that last statement that there's a lot of stuff in our politics that's swayed by noise is for sure true. So let's talk about that noise. Right now, there's a lot of anxiety. My personal anxiety is that I am missing stories, that I am missing part of the world because I am not getting the news that everybody else is, or I'm not getting enough of it. It's kind of nuts, but I have a lot of anxiety about the siloed nature of the world now. Am I right? Am I wrong? I mean, talk to me about that.
One of the biggest problems that we've embedded into American politics is that we have totally different information pipelines depending on who we are, right? And like, I think this is where the United States has a totally broken system that is going to have generational consequences, not just Trumpism, but that will outlast Trump probably. And it's something, you know, I can say as, you know, I live in the UK, I come back to the US every so often, I flip on, you know, Fox News and Newsmax to see what's going on. There's just nothing like that in the developed democracies in the rest of the world. And the sort of propaganda that does exist on the airwaves in the United States is something that I think has also embedded risk in this. Because, you know, you think about like QAnon, for example, and 50% of American Republicans now say that they believe at least one plank of QAnon. I mean, one of those people is going to do something really crazy. And some of them already have, right? A guy tried to like blow up the Hoover Dam at one point and thankfully didn't succeed based on QAnon belief, not to mention the Pizzagate incident where the guy tried to shoot up the pizza joint, right? So I think there's all these things where like we have this illusion of order because we've avoided some of the catastrophes that could have happened. But, you know, I think some of that's luck. I think some of that is just like all the ingredients are there. We've sort of designed a tinderbox and then we're just hoping a spark doesn't fly. And I think, you know, this is the stuff where what I'm talking about with this sort of design of systems and the proneness to flukes today is like, you know, the Arab Spring was a place where everybody was on edge. I mean, all the people were restless and angry about the dictatorships. One guy lights himself on fire and all of a sudden you have a civil war in Syria with hundreds of thousands of people dying, multiple regimes collapse. And so my point is that like, you know, I think we've set up these systems that are just super, super prone to shocks. And the mistake we make is imagining they're like an outlier, that's some weird thing that we couldn't have foreseen. I think we've designed systems that when the noise of life gets into the system, it actually creates these massive consequences. So, you know, that is something I worry about. The information pipelines is one that amplifies it. And I think you're right to worry that we all get a little slice of reality because we exist in information bubbles.
Yeah. When you got back to America this time, we had dinner and we were chatting and you said that you felt like America was a little bit scarier even than it had been a couple years ago when you were here the last time. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's something that's really striking. I've lived abroad for almost 13 years now, and every time I go home, which is multiple times a year, I'm just struck by social dysfunction in a way that is totally alien in many parts of Europe. It's not like Europe or Britain is like some paragon of good governance. Obviously, like, you know, things are messed up really badly over here.
Right. You have Brexit. You have Rishi Sunak. We often have Ian Dunst on here to tell us just about how fucked up you guys are. But yes, continue. Sir.
Yeah. So there are problems. But like, you know, I mean, the way I always explain this to people is the British version of Anthony Fauci is named Chris Whitty, and he's like universally regarded as a hero in the UK. Almost everybody got vaccinated and just sort of followed the rules. We like had this tradition where everyone went out on their doorsteps and clapped for the nurses for like months, right?
Yeah.
Now, I went home to the US in like 2021, and it was like this extreme polarization where you could see whether someone is a Democrat or Republican based on whether they were wearing a mask. And then also like Anthony Fauci is like at credible risk of being murdered. And, you know, these are like little canaries in the coal mine, but it's also like just the visibility of partisanship where, you know, you have these flags everywhere of, you know, Trump or all sorts of things where everything about like a lot of people's lives is sort of their identity is fused with partisanship. And it's just it's like an angrier culture than what I'm used to in the UK. So, you know, I do worry about that because it's long-term stuff. I mean, this is not just like, you know, Trump goes away and then everything's fine. I think there's sort of a vitriol in American politics, an undercurrent of violence that is just so not in many parts of other rich democracies in the world, basically.
Quite, actually quite scary. in my mind. I mean, is Fox News to blame, or is it this sort of right-wing media ecosystem?
I mean, I think it's a combination of right-wing media and politicians who effectively incite violence. I mean, this is the big difference, right? Like, there's decorum in politics in the UK, not perfect. Boris Johnson broke a lot of rules. But if Boris Johnson said that, you know, the top general in the UK maybe should be killed for treason, like Trump did with Mark Milley, it would not just be the end of his political career. He would be shunned by every single politician in his own party. And I think this is the sort of stuff where, like, you just don't see it because it's like, you know, it's the parable of the frog boiling or whatever in the boiling water. It's like, I think a lot of Americans are just like numbed to the fact that it's gotten so insane. I mean, I look at this stuff from over here and there's just a constant stream of the most insane stories and the most insane rhetoric. And, you know, it's just beyond any sort of discourse that exists in the UK. I mean, and I'm not trying to pump up the UK too much because, as I say, there's a lot of problems. But, like, I mean, Boris Johnson got knocked out of office because he had some people over during COVID. Right. And Liz Truss, you know, when she tanked the economy, she had a 9%. I mean, she had a 9% approval rating and was ousted in 49 days. I mean, Trump has had a 40% approval rating since 2016, right? Like, it's like nothing he does matters in terms of his approval. So, you know, I am worried about that, where, like, people don't change their minds in the US and the vitriol is so extreme and the sort of toxic environment of right-wing cable news and so on and propaganda outlets, along with the sort of vile rhetoric of Republicans calling for violence. It's a cocktail made for political violence. And I think that as someone who studies political violence as part of my job, my diagnosis of why there hasn't been worse violence is that we are lucky.
Yeah, that doesn't make me feel better.
No, I know. I mean, this is my honest assessment. Like, I think we have every single ingredient for, like, severe political violence and assassinations and so on. I'm surprised it hasn't happened. I hope it never happens. I hope that this is something where I'm completely wrong about it. But we have politicians stoking hatred. You have extreme media polarization where people don't even agree on reality anymore. You have 400 million guns for a population of 330 million people. I mean, you have this rhetoric that says that Democrats are communists who are trying to basically kidnap your children if you're a QAnon believer for sexual gratification, or just that they're trying to destroy America because they believe that China is, like, you know, better than, but, you know, the best thing since sliced bread. Those delusions are ones that cause people to act. And so, you know, bringing it back to that sense of the flukes and the contingencies, I think we're just sort of in that tinderbox moment. And I'm really worried about how 2024 is going to play out. I know it's not comforting, but it is something where the dynamics are so dysfunctional. I'm frankly surprised that there hasn't been worse violence in the United States. And I would be shocked if 2024 unfolds without any political violence.
Well, that was really upsetting. Tell us how we put the genie back in the bottle.
The number one thing is electoral defeat. Eventually, this will focus the mind of Republicans, and it's what needs to happen. It hasn't happened throughout these last several electoral defeats, but I think that, like, a resounding rejection of the sort of extremism, violent rhetoric, and Trumpism is the first step to getting the party, the Republican Party, back from the brink of this, like, full-on embrace of authoritarian, violent extremism. And barring that, I really worry about it. So I think there's a way that this can happen. I think it's why everyone's actions in 2024 are so important, because this is the most important election, I think, in modern history. And the effects of it could be very positive if the outcome is resounding. And it could be. So, you know, my hope is that there will be a resounding rejection of this, and it will start to dial back this rhetoric and make consequences for those who embrace the sort of rhetoric of violence.
Thanks, Brian.
And now your moment of fuckery.
Jesse Cannon.
Uh-oh, Molly. I'm feeling vibes. I think they're impeachment. Whoa, this is strange. I'm feeling vibes. What are you feeling here?
It's a vibes-based impeachment. Just like in Succession, we can agree these are not serious people. The Republicans in the House of Representatives, fresh off trying to impeach Joe Biden on vibes, have moved on to impeach Alejandro Mayorkas on vibes. Let me just say two things here. You cannot impeach someone because you don't like them. That's not how any of this works. They had a conservative lawyer, Jonathan Turley, who said you can't impeach people for not liking how they're doing their job. It has to actually be an impeachable offense. But God forbid Republicans ever do anything that makes any sense. And for that, they feature prominently House Republicans, yet again, are our moment of fuckery. That's it for this episode of Fast Politics. Tune in every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday to hear the best minds in politics make sense of all this chaos. If you enjoyed what you've heard, please send it to a friend and keep the conversation going. And again, thanks for listening.
Welcome to Season 9 of Next Question with me, Katie Couric. I've got some big news to share with you in our season premiere featuring the one and only Kris Jenner.
Oh my gosh, congratulations. That is very, very exciting.
And that's just the beginning. We'll also be joined by podcast host Jay Shetty, Hillary Clinton, Renee Fleming, Liz Cheney, and many more. So come on in, take a break from the incessant negativity for a weekly dose of fascinating conversations. Some of them, I promise, will actually put you in a good mood. Listen to Next Question with me, Katie Couric, on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
MTV's official Challenge podcast is back for another season.
And so are we.
I'm Tori Deal.
And I'm Anissa Ferreira.
The wait is over, guys. All Stars 4 is finally here.
And this season takes it to a whole new level. Old school legends, modern power players, and ex-lovers are all competing in Cape Town, South Africa for the prize of $300,000.
And we're going to be right here along with you fans, covering every episode on the podcast.
Listen to MTV's official Challenge podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Bring a little optimism into your life with The Bright Side, a new kind of daily podcast from Hello Sunshine, hosted by me, Danielle Robay,
and me, Simone Boyce. Every weekday, we're bringing you conversations about culture, the latest trends, inspiration, and so much more.
I am so excited about this podcast, The Bright Side. You guys are giving people a chance to shine a light on their lives, shine a light on a little advice that they want to share.
Listen to The Bright Side on America's number one podcast network, iHeart. Open your free iHeart app and search The Bright Side.
Imagine you ask two people the same seven questions. I'm Minnie Driver, and this was the idea I set out to explore in my podcast, Mini Questions. This year, we bring a whole new group of guests to answer the same seven questions, including Courtney Cox, Rob Delaney, Liz Phair, and many, many more. Join me on Season 3 of Mini Questions on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your favorite podcasts. Seven questions, limitless answers.